Welcome to Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George. I'd like to welcome my guests and my listeners and a special guest, Dr. Marilyn Singleton. Dr. Singleton is an anesthesiologist, and she's also an Association of American Physicians and Surgeons member, and she's been a really amazing guest in the past. And she wrote an article that I read yesterday that just basically blew me away, because I knew that there was something brewing. You know, we were talking about death panels, and you know, the people in favor of the Affordable Care Act have been whining that, oh, it's just alarmist and people aren't telling the truth and it's just a fear tactic, all the things that they were trying to say and have been saying and continue to say about people who are who've read the bill, who actually are critical thinkers and who see where this is going. I was looking for proof, and Dr. Singleton wrote an article that gave us proof. So, Dr. Singleton, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, I am so glad to be here. It's nice to talk with you again, Doctor.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I tell you, you wrote the most amazing article that I've read recently, and it wasn't alarmist. It was just the facts, the cold, hard facts, and it was projection as to where this bill, this change in our healthcare system is really going and why it has to go there. So if I left anything out and you want to tell us anything else about yourself, please feel free before you start off.
The only other thing to add in there, in the midst of all my medicine, I went to law school so I could try to get in the heads of these folks that write these laws, and practiced healthcare law for a while, always still practicing medicine because I'm a doctor at heart, and that's that.
Isn't that something? Now that you've been inside, or you've gotten inside their heads, what are they thinking when they write these bills?
One of the things that struck me is that lawyers think more theoretically, and I think doctors think more one by one and person by person, if I were to make a generalization. And many times, what works on paper just doesn't work in real life because there's that X factor of human nature that sometimes is not worked into some of these laws. And I think that's what we find when laws that everybody says, oh, gee, that sounds okay. Mm-hmm. And it sounds okay at the first sentence. But if you don't look beyond your nose and don't look two steps out at the unintended consequences, that's how we get in trouble.
Do you think that's it sounds like you think, or in your opinion, there's a little bit of innocence associated with writing these bills. It's like the
good
of the
many. I really do think so. One, you realize that the Congress people, very few of them, actually know what's in the bills. Nancy Pelosi was so right when she said we have to pass the bill so we can see what's in it. Various lobbyists and people who are professional bill writers sit there and write the bill. Somebody comes up with a kernel, an idea, and says, okay, let's throw this together and make it into a bill. And an idea sounds good. The idea that everyone will be healthy and we'll all have a happy life, of course that's a wonderful idea. But how to do it, and how to do it with all the vagaries of human beings and that everyone's not perfect and everyone's not an angel, that they don't work. And those things aren't considered because who's writing the bill is one, they're being very technical, and then there's the politician who wants to get reelected. So there's all those things that go into it. And certainly everyone knows that the health care law is very complex, very convoluted, and not straightforward, and makes revisions to bill or laws that are existing already, makes it very hard to follow, makes it very hard to figure out, okay, what's it ultimately saying? And a lot of people don't even know.
I know. I read an article that 40% of Americans don't even know that the health care bill has actually been passed, which is an amazing statistic, isn't it?
It is. And you know how, what was that old joke about treating people like mushrooms, keep them in the dark, and, you know, that's an uninformed. Mm-hmm. And that's what, it actually scares me how uninformed people are. And it's almost like a willful ignorance, because it's almost as though if you know the truth, you'd be crying day and night.
Isn't that the case? Well, you know, I really respect what you said about the people, the legislators who are, you know, they have benign reasoning behind it. See, I take a slightly different view. That same segue to willful ignorance, it's complicity, in my opinion. Uh-huh. It's about selfishness. It's about staying in power at all costs. It's about getting money for your next campaign. And it's about making sure that your hands stay clean. They can all say, oh, we didn't read the bill, so we didn't know that death panels are in it. We didn't know that you're going to snatch away health care from those who do have insurance currently. Or no, we didn't know that it's going to cause basically more misery than it's going to help people. And that's, you know, plausible deniability in this case. Would you say?
Oh, I think you're right there. They certainly aren't all sitting there quiet, pretty, and innocent. I do believe some people honestly think that, yes, this is a good thing, but I believe it's misguided, and I just think they haven't thought about it.
Well, let's talk about the money, because I think everything comes down to follow the money. When you say that, I remember when this was being concocted, who came up to the White House? It wasn't a private practitioner, an independent physician in the mix at all. It was all special interest groups, the AMA, the unions, the hospital corporation, pharmaceutical industry, and the medical insurance industry. Those are the major players in driving healthcare, and, which is really sad, the cost of healthcare. Isn't it ironic that they got to run this show?
Oh, it's totally crazy. And putting in a plug for Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, way back in the 90s when Hillary Clinton was trying to pull a health care bill together, one of the things that AAPS did was help expose her committee of folks, and not a single doctor at the table. And amusingly, one of the reasons they said, oh, doctors can't be at the table because they're a special interest group.
That's classic.
Oh, it really was. I mean, some of the things these people say, you wonder, where are their minds? But, and that actually went to federal court, and they said, no, you can't have a secret committee like that. And that's how, I mean, people kind of knew there was no doctor on the committee, and then it became exposed. But this is how physicians are treated with regard to policymaking, mm-hmm. and that's another scary trend, of course. Are physicians just going to become some sort of puppet and a tool of a larger bureaucracy? And you wonder, where's that individual judgment going to be?
That's an excellent point. Now, I believe that that's already happening. I believe that physicians have been incorporated, indoctrinated, and in some cases made to perform like puppets under duress to run the system.
Oh, I agree with you. And many people fear with the new health law that there's two big things. Because there will be, and already is, a shortage of primary care physicians, one, there will be more quote-unquote physician extenders who do have a place in medicine, but I don't believe as complete private practitioners on their own. And just today, there was an article about misdiagnoses in medicine, and that there's 14% of cases where there's a problem. It started off with an initial misdiagnosis. So if people who have 4 years of medical school and 3 years of residency can misdiagnose, imagine what someone with 4 years of post-high school training will do. And it's just an issue of training level. So one, I think people will have lesser skilled people to go to, mm-hmm. to have as their provider. And two, that if they need physicians to take care of patients, that taking care of patients on Medicaid might start being a prerequisite to renewing your medical license.
Oh, you hit the nail right on the head on that one. That's my major fear, that we will be dragged into this system because they need bodies to run it. And they can't do it all with medical assistants and physician assistants and nurse practitioners. They need physicians at some point. And they're doing it already in some senses with maintenance of certification, which is popping up all over the country. And I mean, I've talked about it on my show before, but for if you want to take the ball on this and let our listeners know what maintenance of certification is, feel free.
Basically, in a nutshell, when most doctors these days have taken special tests, the so-called boards of whatever their specialty is, to be able to become board certified, showing that you had special training in that area and were able to pass the test. And you take your boards, they're fairly rigorous, written test and then oral boards, and then you're board certified in your specialty. And all through your medical career, to renew your license, you have to take continuing education. In California, it's 100 units every 2 years. So it's a significant amount of continuing education. Now some areas are saying that you have to recertify yourself, retake the test in order to keep your board certification. No one knows any other specialty that I can think of where you have to completely recertify all your boards. And the continuing education, I'm all for it. We all need to keep up with what's going on and mm-hmm. learn things and go to workshops, et cetera. But this maintenance of certification, that, as you point out, it's the first step to saying that, okay, can't get your license unless you're recertified, and then step two, can't renew your license unless you take 7% Medicaid patients or whatever
exactly.
number they come up with.
I mean, it's you're guilty until proven innocent. You know, there's some states that, you know, I don't mind having a background check. I think that's reasonable. But the mm-hmm. questions that they ask and the fingerprinting, the urine samples, it's like you're a criminal. I'm pretty sure lawyers don't have to go through this, and most professionals on Wall Street, I'm sure, don't have to go through this.
Lawyers do get fingerprinted.
But not urine analysis and background checks and pedophile checks, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that allergy season in Georgia is year-round? Beginning in July through November, ragweed is the predominant pollen. But February through May, tree pollen causes allergy symptoms. Grass pollen occurs from mid-May through the beginning of July. If you suffer from daily nasal congestion, sneezing, runny nose, headache, ear clogging, or popping, or a chronic cough, these symptoms may be due to allergy and not infection. You should also think of allergies if there is no fever, chills, or colored mucus. Treatment should include nasal salt water sprays over the counter or antihistamines that do not cause drowsiness. If you have persistent headaches, a decrease in your sense of smell, or nosebleeds, you should see an ear, nose, and throat physician. Please join me on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
For years, Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center has been providing outstanding care to patients of all ages. They are dedicated to patient satisfaction and have been the recipient of the Georgia Otolaryngology Association Patient Satisfaction Award. They welcome any questions you may have about their services. Their practice includes treatment of asthma, allergies, sleep apnea, snoring, hearing impairments, and chronic sinus disease. Dr. Elena George is a board-certified ear, nose, and throat surgeon. Her training in New York has included training at Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital and Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She believes in practicing both the art and science of medicine. All patients are seen by Dr. George. All treatment options are discussed, and time will be spent to answer all questions. Their office is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road in Suite 260 North Tower, two blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, you can be confident that you are in good hands with their professional team.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. This is Dr. George, and my special guest, honored guest today, is Dr. Marilyn Singleton. Now, I know I glossed over your credentials at the beginning, but I really want to go back to them because you are speaking from authority. You're an anesthesiologist, you're a professor, you graduated from Stanford and then got your medical degree at UCSF, and you spent time at Harvard's Beth Israel Hospital in anesthesia residency, and then you were professor, assistant clinical professor of anesthesiology and critical care medicine at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. So you know from the inside, surgeon, academician, practicing physician, and to top it off, a lawyer, which means you can navigate this legalese, which gives me personally a headache. I don't know how you do it. I thought reading medical texts were, you know, that was pretty straightforward, but going to read a brief or something or that Affordable Care Act, it literally gave me a headache. It was like you were reading in circles. And I guess they want you to do that so you can't figure out what the upshot is.
That's exactly right. Nobody can cross-reference. Most of the law is cross-references to the Internal Revenue Code and back to the Social Security Act, the section on Medicare and Medicaid, and it says section whatever is revised to include. So you'd have to go back and see what it said before and what they're adding to it, and nobody's going to do all that.
It took about 2 weeks to make it through, and I just knew that the bigger picture was, hey, this is not about patient care. That was my take-home message from this. It's about control. It's about taxing, and it's about taking power from the doctor and the patient, the healthcare decisions, and giving it to a collective committee run by the government with government appointees that have nothing to do with real-world healthcare. Is that a decent synopsis?
I think you're absolutely right. And this whole concept of running things by the collective is one of the things that comes up with made me feel compelled to write about advanced directives, that you see how an idea that starts off as, gee, seems like a good idea at the time, that in the beginning people were worried that things would be done to them against their will because they really wanted to die quietly, and so we have advanced directives that say, please don't plug me into things, let me die quietly, if I'm in a coma, whatever. But the point was, it was giving a person a choice to do that. There were some people that still wanted to be, quote-unquote, plugged into everything. Now, it seems like it's a one-way choice. And there are hospital ethics committees that will ultimately make the decision. So even though you've signed an advance directive thinking, oh, I said I wanted everything done, it could turn out that the committee will decide that, no, that wasn't a wise choice for you. And there's just something that strikes me wrong. Now, whether I want to be plugged in or not, that it doesn't matter. And whether you personally say, oh, gee, I wouldn't want that done to me, that's not the point. You have to look at the bigger picture and say, what about somebody who does? What kind of policies can we have rather than just making it where the default choice is unplug the person? to work something out where everyone's interests could be served, but primarily the patient, not the system, and work the system to include the patient rather than the other way around.
How did it happen that we went from, in the living will, just advanced directive is the same thing as a living will for our listeners, correct?
Mm-hmm.
How did it morph from the patient-centered, this is what I want to, like a will, this is what I want to be done in catastrophic conditions when I can't tell you. How did it go from that to a committee and an ethics board saying, I don't care what you want, we're pulling the plug? Is that legal?
I think part of it, again, doctor, back to what you said about you have to follow the money. Because initially, oh, a person's suffering and we don't want them to suffer. And then as medical care got better and better and better and technology became more advanced, you could see that there can be much more done on people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether necessarily it would improve them or not, but until you try, you wouldn't know. And the costs just are starting to get higher and higher. So what we need to look at are the costs, but not to sacrifice the patients until we figure out a way to deal with it.
Well, it seems to me that we're missing the major... It always happens this way. We have these, for example, walks and bracelets for breast cancer or prostate cancer, whatever it is, but there's no real talk about how do you stop it. It's always after the fact, and it's always after it's some foundation making reams of money based on disease, but not really getting rid of the problem. They don't want to get rid of the problem, and this is my take on this whole healthcare cost situation. The hospitals are running up these bills. They're gouging patients. They have unbelievable margins, and no one's talking about that. It's the doctor, because we're the easy pickings. We're the low-hanging fruit. We're doing it. We're ordering extra tests. We're the ones who are cutting feet off and taking tonsils out because we want to make money. And in actuality, the hospitals are making boatloads of money on every Tylenol, every garbage can, every porta potty that they put in your room. And nobody's saying a thing about that. How does that work?
What's fascinating to me is way back when, and it was, when I was a house officer, a resident, an intern, medical student, Medicare would not pay for a barium enema, an x-ray, just with a patient drinking a solution that could go down their colon.
Mm-hmm.
That could not be done as an outpatient. That Medicare would only pay if that were done in the hospital. Now, what a simple test. It wasn't even invasive. It was taking an x-ray. But it, even back then, before I was a young kid, not even looking politically aware or anything, something struck me as odd about this. And the first thing I thought, what deal did the hospital make to make such an easy test not get paid for unless it was done on the hospital premises? And so that concept was brewing, that there was more to these laws than meets the eye. And then as it turns out, that you see that it's the various lobbyists who write the laws.
Uh-huh.
And there is a way to take care of people without gouging them. And I just look at something very simple, that why doesn't Medicare pay people to take care of someone at home, to help them out at home, so they don't have to go to the hospital? And there are just a lot of payments that I think that could be less expensive and could still well take care of somebody. A person can have IVs at home. You can have a lot of these things. But and if the doctors deem this person to be terminal, then don't give me the excuse, oh, you might mess up the IV. Well, you decided they were going to die anyway, so, mm-hmm. give me a chance to try. There's creative things that people could come up with, but I don't think there's the desire to get creative, because the easy way out is on one hand, gouge people for money, and then on the other hand, oh, when we're tired of it, pull the plug.
It's not a no-win situation for the patient. And, you know, I think transparency would be a really important step to breaking this monopoly. It's a cartel at this point. And I don't know about California, but in Georgia, there was a legislative coup that the hospitals won when they decided that independent docs with the surgery centers, independent surgery centers, were a threat and competition that they couldn't fight against. So they mandated a law that you couldn't open any more private surgery centers. It was like a moratorium on it. Then they proceeded to buy major surgery centers throughout the city and close them or incorporate them into the hospital. So now as a physician, as a surgeon, you don't have a lot of choices for your patient. You either have to go to a hospital proper, hospital-owned surgery center, and if you're lucky, a freestanding outpatient surgery center. And they are getting crushed because their reimbursements from Medicare and insurance companies is a fraction of what it is for the hospitals. And all through this, the hospitals have been crying poor while they're building new wings. There's like 50 flat-screen TVs in one of the ORs that I used to go to. It's money upon money in those things, and it's just incredible.
And wow. And this is part of this, when you look at that, and then you look at the internal medicine side with these ACOs, Accountable Care Organizations, trying to herd physicians into giant groups, where then once they're in a giant group, then altogether they will be more malleable, so you can take care of 20 people at a time, 30 people at a time, and herd them into whatever policy or program you want. And in this case, I think it makes it where private offices then meld with the hospital. Mm-hmm. Then the next thing you know, the hospital is melding with the government. And then the handful of private practitioners left are out in the cold.
Absolutely. And the sad part about the, quote, Affordable Care Act is that every choice that it's made, every iteration of this bill, is the most expensive iteration. So instead of being able to go to a private practitioner, private physician, you have to go to really an accountable care doc who's associated with a hospital whose fee scale is hugely different than a private practitioner. I've had patients say, one patient came to me and told me, I've been with my doctor for over 40 years, and I had to leave them because he sold his practice to the hospital, and I couldn't afford his fees anymore. And the doctor had to go and tell the patient, I have to get permission from the financial department to give you a discount. Are you kidding me? So this is where I have to get permission from the hospital to give you a discount. You've been my patient for 40 years, and I no longer can work one-to-one with you. Welcome to Obamacare.
That's right. And that's the problem of once you have to get in an organization, then you have to follow the organizational rules. And, yes, there's some rules that are quite good and that make it where they're trying to make things safe, and we don't want people running around being quacks and all this type thing, but your payment scales and how you choose to handle one patient versus another, that should be up to you, and you should be able to do it on the spot. Somebody comes in, they just lost their job, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it might be, but you have that relationship with the person. You say, okay, fine, you get the I just lost my job discount rate today.
Exactly.
And to not have that ability, because to me, that helps strengthen the bond between the doctor and patient. They know you're human. They know that you're looking at them as a person mm-hmm. and not another electronic medical record.
Exactly.
Real-life human being.
Or a cost center. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Have you heard of quantitative fluid analysis? Commonly called QFA, this test assesses your body at a cellular level and gives insight into your illness. Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center offers the QFA, an FDA-approved test that can often provide early diagnosis of conditions before they can be detected with other tests. Dr. Elana George believes in an integrative approach to medicine. She believes in treating the problem and not the symptom. Following a review of your results, Dr. George will suggest treatment approaches such as nutritional counseling and or the use of pharmaceutical-grade enzymes and nutritional supplements. Surgery and prescription medication will be recommended only when necessary. Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road Northwest in Suite 260 North Tower, two blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. Call their office at 404-591-9100 to make an appointment and mention that you heard this ad on Radio Sandy Springs and get 10% off of QFA testing.
Moms, dads, listen to my radio program, Homeschooling for Today, on Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you'll learn all about how to homeschool on America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Elana George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that chronic nasal congestion, a decreased sense of smell, and asthma can be signs of allergies? Allergies are caused when the body is exposed to things you breathe in or eat that the body does not like. The body's immune system reacts and attacks it, what it perceives to be the enemy, even if it causes no harm, like pet dander or dust. This leads to swelling. In the nose, this causes congestion. In the bowel, it causes stomach bloating and diarrhea. In the lung, it causes shortness of breath and wheezing. And in the skin, it causes hives and itching. The first line of defense against allergy is avoidance. Dustproofing, washing pets, and keeping them out of the bedroom can help with environmental causes. For food allergies, keeping a diary of things eaten and reaction to them is helpful. Allergy testing is less time-consuming and is a safe and effective way to identify allergies. For a complete evaluation, you should see your allergy specialist.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're speaking today with my special guest, Dr. Marilyn Singleton. She's both an anesthesiologist, a professor, and a lawyer, and who practices in California. And she's written an article entitled, Death Panels are Already at a Hospital Near You. Now, I wanted to go into more detail about really a nuts and bolts day-to-day. What does this mean? If someone's loved one is in the hospital and they happen to be, I don't think this even matters if you're a senior citizen, a young child, an able-bodied adult, if you end up in a situation that is deemed to be, you know, end-of-life care is not going to work, what do they do to you? What's going on that people need to look out for?
What happens is the case is taken to a hospital ethics committee, and the ethics committee has various policies, and each hospital has a different policy. And there is a survey done and where they looked at 27 hospitals in California, and 24 out of the 27 did have a policy regarding this. So it's something that people need to ask their doctor. Do you know the hospital policy of end-of-life care? Mm-hmm. And so you're able to ask your doctor, will you advocate for me? It's very interesting because the term that's used is medically ineffective treatment. But it's the doctor that determines, is it medically ineffective? And if one doctor says it's medically ineffective, then you take it to the committee. The committee decides, yes, it is, pull the plug, and it doesn't matter what you said on your advance directive. But if another doctor says it isn't, then the plug isn't pulled. So clearly that term isn't so clear and so defined that all doctors could agree that a treatment is medically ineffective. And given that there's ambiguity, I feel like you have to err on the side of life since death is irreversible.
Exactly. And do no harm. You know, that's part of our Hippocratic Oath, at least those of us that took it.
But some people think, oh, if the person's suffering, then that's doing harm. But again, to me, the point of the advance directive was being able to say, I don't care, and for whatever reason, maybe they want to suffer, maybe they aren't suffering, I don't know, but that's not for me to decide. I'm not in their head. I don't know what they went through. I may not know their past. There might be something they feel they have to atone for. Maybe they did something bad in their past, and that's their way of making peace with God. I don't know, so it's not for me to cut that short if that's what the patient wanted.
Well, do you think that that Big Brother, that mentality is becoming more prevalent in society? There's a lot of that going on.
Absolutely. And I think a big example of how we know that it is the fact that when Obama was talking to college students and telling them, oh, don't believe it about fearing your government, when that was a core principle of this nation, is always keep an eye open, because tyranny can happen quite easily. It can happen behind your back, and you don't even know it. And I think too many people now are forgetting history and that how easily tyranny creeps up. And it generally creeps up when the government starts giving you a gift. And, you know, it's like, oh, boy. And then the next thing you know, look at the string that's attached to that gift.
Oh, you said a mouthful on that one. I want to tease the legal side of this, because I'm so blessed to have you on the show, because you can talk about things that I kind of surmise. You understand the nuance. Talk to us about the Uniform Healthcare Decisions Act. And it was passed in 1994, I think.
Well, what it is, the Uniform Healthcare Decisions Act is like many things called model legislation. And what model legislation is, it's not things that are actually passed by anybody. It's professors and academics and people in a field get together and write what would be a model law. And then what happens, and this is in all professions, there's something called the Uniform Commercial Code, and there's Uniform Building Codes, and what some states do, that way they don't have to write their own from scratch. They take the Uniform Code and then just wholesale adopt it into law. And then they might add one sentence here, one sentence there, to fit their particular state. So the Uniform Healthcare Decisions Act is a model legislation. And so states can take it and adopt it or use some of the phrases out of it. And that's generally what happens. Then people don't have to reinvent the wheel, as they say. And what this did was make it so states could make it part of their law that it was okay for a doctor to unplug the patient and they wouldn't get sued for not taking care of them. And it would only be if you did that, that when the patient was terminal, but each state defines what this terminal condition is. Some states, it's if you're unconscious, which is considered to be permanently unconscious, or have an irreversible condition. And all of these things I find odd. Now, admittedly, not that many people wake up from very long comas, but people do. Just recently in the news, there was that woman who woke up after 30 or 40 years. And, I mean, those are rare. But it doesn't mean it doesn't happen, and it doesn't mean that if a family wanted to take care of somebody, then to go ahead and let them stay there. This woman's family was taking care of her. And then the other thing that bothers me is when you say it's an incurable or irreversible condition. What about Stephen Hawking's, the genius physicist. He has a terminal and irreversible condition, but he's still alive, and alive with a whole lot of help.
Mm-hmm.
And if he weren't Stephen Hawking, would he be dead? I would think yes, that he has the means and the opportunity to keep himself alive, therefore he's alive.
You know, theoretically, what this could expand into is these committees, whether they be hospital-based, government-based, legislatively, deciding who's a valuable citizen. And those that are deemed to be unworthy in whatever way that the government or the entity chooses to say that you're unworthy, we're not going to give you care. We want to get rid of you. That's really what it sounds like to me.
It's one of those things where you don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but you just have to look at history and next steps. I look at NICE, the British system, where that's the committee that decides cost-effective treatments, and they came up with this quality-adjusted years of life. And when you know that there's formulas out there, and that's what's being used to decide whether it's worth it to give somebody a chemotherapy drug or whatever, so the formulas are out there. So it would be very easy to take the next step and then just plug somebody into a formula.
Absolutely. I mean, I think they've done that with something called the Liverpool pathway in the British national healthcare system, where if the person was deemed to be end of life or somehow not medically treatable, that they would just withdraw their food and their water. That's their model of euthanasia. I mean, I wouldn't do this to an animal. It's like people don't count. And I know that I read an article that you referred me to yesterday, and I think this is moving towards an academic pronouncement that, from my take on this, it's starting from the time before you're born to the time you die in this country. I've seen bioethicists write that children aren't children until they're, 2 years old, up to 5 years old, and you can abort them, and it's not even like you're killing a human being. To this article that says that, or it's called Religion Powers End-of-Life Care, which means that people who actually believe in God somehow are costing the system more because they want to use the services. That's what's implied in this article.
Yes. And you know, people kind of laugh when they say there's a war on religion, but even people who aren't religious can take note that religion is demonized, to turn a phrase. And nobody says you have to be religious, but you don't have to condone the constant making fun of people who are, and that somehow that's okay, and that people see nothing wrong with it, and people see nothing wrong with even having a discussion about the morality of issues. That's what bothers me, is people don't want to hear it. They don't want to discuss it because they might find that the differing opinion is right. I always can begin a discussion on just the idea that they're trying to devalue life across the board, and of course a lot of people who are pro-life certainly believe this. There's a British satirist who looked at abortion this way. He said, you just have to challenge people when you try to redefine terms. He says, tell this to some pro-choice person when they come up to you with an ultrasound and say, oh, look at my baby. And you just turn and look at them and say, oh, I thought it was just a clump of cells. That this concept that it can't be one thing one minute and something else the other minute, that you just have to say, okay, then I guess if you called it a baby, even though this ultrasound is at 4 weeks, then you're admitting it's a baby. Now, if you want to be pro-choice, then say, okay, it's a baby, but I'm choosing to end the life. And we can do that all across the board. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're a bad person, but it makes you have to face a moral dilemma. And I think one of the things we're doing in society more and more, and one of the advantages of the government making all your decisions for you, is you no longer have to face moral dilemmas. And that's part of being a human being.
All right.
And I think there's going to be a point where people won't even know what it means to be in a moral dilemma and have to examine their internal feelings and is there a higher power, and, you know, all the things that go into having to make a big decision.
Oh, I think you've made an excellent point, and I want to pick that up when we come back. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know skipping doses of medication can be dangerous? If you have a chronic medical condition like diabetes or high blood pressure, it's important to take the medication prescribed by your physician. It is also important to remember that although you take a medicine to treat a condition, it is not a cure for the underlying medical condition. It is used to control it. For example, taking medication for diabetes will lower your blood sugar. However, if you stop taking the medication, the sugar will rise again. Changes in both diet and lifestyle, like adding exercise to your routine, are equally important. Working with your physician by following his or her recommendations is the key to controlling your disease and maintaining your health. Ask questions if you don't understand something. Taking control of your health is the key to wellness. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, they provide better quality care. They believe that excellent medical care is a right and not a privilege. They are concerned that the current economy has forced people to sacrifice their health. They have therefore reduced their prices to make it more affordable. They will continue to provide state-of-the-art care. They continue to believe that patient care counts above all else. Peachtree ENT Center, concierge medicine without the concierge price. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. Call their office at 404-591-9100 to make an appointment or for more information. They are located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road Northwest, Suite 260 North Tower, 2 blocks south of Piedmont Hospital.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're having an enlightening conversation with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And Dr. Singleton, we only have about 9 minutes left, but I think we're getting into the most serious part of our conversation, because this is morality, this is ethics, this is very deep stuff. It's not about money. It's not about which side wins, you know, liberal, conservative. It's not about that. It's about being a human being. And one thing that I've found that's really becoming very pervasive is this false creation of lack in all aspects of our society. You know, we have these Gulf spill, oil spills, which ruins the food supply there. You've got droughts, you've got floods, you've got physicians being driven out of the profession, and now you have even further lack of doctors in it. It's always a crisis mode. And whether it's real or created, that's debatable. My opinion is something's afoot to drive people into the siege mentality where I'm so overwhelmed, I just want the government or somebody to take care of me, and I'll do whatever you want for my safety, for my health, for my well-being. It's like everybody's giving away their personal choice and their right and their need to run their own lives. And healthcare is a huge thing. If we give that up, people will not be able to get that back very easily.
I think you're absolutely right, and I do believe that turning something into a crisis is manufactured, not to say that some of the things that happened aren't really big things, but when you look back, you could see it coming, and if you told people to prepare, and I think you really hit on something, the idea that then people are caught unaware, so of course the government is the only one that has the resources to take care of it. Mm-hmm. But just look at how health savings accounts, money essentially was taken out of them by having a bigger penalty for withdrawal and putting a limit on how much you could put into a flexible savings account at work. Something that would have you more in charge of your health care, they start taking away. Mm-hmm. So then you are more dependent on somebody else to pick up the bill. And there's so many things that you could do to help take care of yourself. But if that's not encouraged or even putting it out there, you know, mm-hmm. you could do this yourself. You don't need, you know, X, Y, or Z to do this. Then we'd be ready, and you wouldn't be crying for the government. And more, I think, though, as some of these disasters occur, the hurricanes and Katrina or whatever that people see, you know what? I do need to be more prepared myself, and I can't wait for the government to take care of me. And hopefully more people will see this. I look at people in the Midwest and how houses in the Midwest have these basements that you can go into if there's a tornado and whatnot. Mm-hmm. That way back when, people built those houses and knew they had to be prepared. They knew what the weather was like there. And more now, people say, okay, I'll build that house on stilts right over the water in hurricane country because guess what? I'll get the government to take care of the problem.
Exactly. And when you apply that mentality to healthcare, and the crisis that we always hear about is the cost of healthcare. You know, it's just going up no matter what we do. Even the Democrats are now talking about, oh, we can't implement the Affordable Care Act because it's going to be too expensive and we need more money. And now there's this group of people, this strident voice of saying, like this article, it's like being in a boat that's the lifeboat after the boat is capsized. And you have these people saying, well, you're too fat, you're too skinny, you're not helpful, you just need to be thrown over the other side because only able-bodied people need to stay in this boat. That's what they're doing with this. And to me, and this article, I think everybody needs to read it. They're saying that if you believe in God, this is if you extrapolate what they're saying, that you are taking up resources. And we need to find some way to stop people from having hope and believing in a higher power so that we can control them. And there was this part of it that I loved. Well, I didn't love it. I just shocked. I take that back. I was shocked. Where people who got spiritual help or counseling, whatever it was, from their doctor, I don't know how this worked, but they were more likely to want to end their life quicker. They didn't want, you know, heroic measures. Now, doesn't that make you think, what are they teaching doctors in medical school that they can talk patients into basically ending their lives so quickly?
It made me wonder, and it could just be poor writing or, you know, the study wasn't the world's best, but on one hand, I thought, okay, I read it, and it might mean that if you had everyone around you, including your doctor, mm-hmm. who was on the same page spiritually, you felt more of a connection and maybe felt ready to go meet your maker. I don't know. It was hard to interpret what that was really supposed to mean. And the bottom line was I felt that it gave me this sense that religion was giving you false hope, so if you're religious, ha, ha, ha on you, you're a fool. And I guess we shouldn't spend any health care dollars on you because religion and faith is a foolish thought.
Well, what's your take on the other part of it or the other take-home message? And I'm going to read part of this, part of what was written. The researchers also suggested that an examination of spiritual support near the end of life in African Americans specifically would be instructive, which meant to me that because most African Americans are pretty religious and in their study they were more likely to use ICUs and and extend their lives, that they needed to be an audience that should be targeted so that we can get them, you know, to stop thinking that God is first and they should want to, you know, go down the toilet faster as well. That to me is eugenics.
I thought it was odd. And this is the sort of thing, if a so-called black leader were to read, assuming they weren't co-opted by the political process, would come up with exactly the same take you just did. And these are the things I wonder, why aren't people screaming about that, that somebody has taken a group of people who, you know, the presumption is that they're more religious and go to church and believe in Jesus and the resurrection, et cetera, mm-hmm. that to correlate that to health care and then try to sway people against those beliefs, my goodness.
It's scary, you know, isn't it?
What are we coming to?
Well, as long as you and I are here on this earth, we're going to make sure that we put our voices out there so that we don't come to that, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just thank you for getting the word out there, and people just, people can think what they want to think, but people have to get the facts. Otherwise, there will be no more critical thinking in America.
Amen to that. Hey, if my listeners want to reach you, how can they do that?
That they can reach me directly at Marilyn M. Singleton at gmail.com.
Listen, I hope you will consider coming back on the show. I love having you on the show. I learned so much.
Oh, and I love being on your show, and I'm just thank you again for having it.
Anytime. Looking forward to the next time.
Okay.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Medicine on Call. I'll see you next week.